Satraps maintained contact with the king using a messenger system that expanded the Assyrian road network that was created centuries earlier. Herodotus writes admiringly about the Persian royal roads, and these roads linked the satrapal capitals with the Persian capital cities. A messenger could ride from Sardis, which was the capital of Lydia, to Susa, the administrative center of the Persians in Iran, in 3 weeks. There were way stations set up at a day's interval, just as the Assyrians had, and these were supplied with horses and food. Only authorized travelers could use these facilities. Soldiers would protect vulnerable spots along the road to prevent trouble and interference with these messengers. Coinage was introduced in the 6th century BC as a way for the king to ensure payment for his armies in distant provinces. Coins were stamped with images of the king, and thus we can see them as a very effective way for the ruler to communicate with his troops. I should say that coins were not used nearly as commonly as they are today. Usually, coins were used only with transactions in large sums. So, for example, the tribute being sent to the Persian king might be sent in coins. And private individuals would rarely be involved in transactions that required coinage. They would continue to use barter systems or lump metal. The iconography of the gold coins shows the king as an archer. So we see him, we see the Persian king adopting a traditional pose that rulers had used for millennia. But there was no standard system of stamping the coins with the king's image. It seems to have been a somewhat haphazard process. The Persians did not have to face the persistent revolts in their satrapies that earlier empires did. Egypt would prove to be troublesome, as it often has been. But otherwise, the state was notably quiet in comparison to the Assyrian or even to the Babylonian regimes. Neo-Babylonian rulers had defeated Assyria and essentially took over their empire, both in ideology as well as the geographical extent. But the shift in the tone of their royal accounts stresses their constructive activities. At Babylon, we saw this illustrated most vividly by the construction sponsored by Nebuchadnezzar. There's no question that they supported these projects with the plunder, tribute, deportations, and taxes in the same way that the Assyrians had sponsored their projects in centuries before. After a long period of invasion and war in southern Mesopotamia, this native rule allowed the infrastructure of the region to be rebuilt. Canals were restored and maintained regularly, and this brought the productivity of the region back to what we had seen in the early part of the course. Nabonidus was an anomaly with his attention to the moon god Sin, and this is explained in part by his mother, or perhaps by their joint Syrian origin, where the moon god was especially popular. But it caused offense in Babylon, and this may have helped Cyrus take advantage of his position nearby. Cyrus offers an impressive example of a founder of a new empire. His success in battle is demonstrated by his swift capture first of Media, then Anatolia, and with his march on Babylonia, the incorporation of the territory west to the Mediterranean. Cyrus has an unusually favorable reputation as a result both of his reaction against Nabonidus's radical behavior, and also his permission to allow the Jews to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. We've begun to get a sense of what aspects of Persian kingship will be idealized: a well-organized and governed empire, and some building activity, but the key is administration. Cyrus's son Cambyses succeeded him without any immediate challenge and eagerly turned to annex Egypt. One of the few threats to dynastic control occurred while Cambyses was away, when a rival noble, Darius, was part of an intricate conspiracy to seize the throne. Darius succeeded, but after this coup, royal succession remained secure until the end of the Persian Empire.